KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest has written a fair number of what I would call psychological detective stories about the self in popular culture and about people who are really pursuing an ideal and profoundly lacking self-awareness. We're going to talk about one of these people in particular, given this kind of, sort of, the 60th anniversary of Spider-Man. The first issue is a cover dated 1963, but that's another long, weird story. My guest is Abraham Josephine Reisman. Her book, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, which is more specifically titled True Believer, we're going to be talking about that. And Josie, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. This is very exciting.
You do have this interesting pivot towards people who think of themselves as being one thing, but are really something else entirely different and can't really see the difference between those two poles.
So far, at least, you know, who knows what the future holds, but the books that I've written and the book that I'm writing are all about men, and they are men, who created myths around themselves and then occupied those myths to a point where it became difficult for them and everyone around them to distinguish between myth and reality. And to be honest, part of the point of why I write these books is I really think we as a species, as a society, as a whatever, put too much weight on the idea that there is an easy distinction between fact and fiction. We spend a lot of time going, oh, well, we know what's right and wrong, or we know what's true or false. And in reality, those values are often very obscured from us. And when we create a persona around ourselves, it's very easy to get lost in it and forget what the original intention of that persona was.
I guess I find it interesting, too, because both in the cases of Stan Lee and in Vince McMahon, they both found a way to sort of seize these basically what were like throwaway marginal elements of popular culture when they found them, and both saw ways to elevate them.
Absolutely. Both Stan and Vince, Stan in comic books and Vince in professional wrestling, found themselves somewhat accidentally, for Vince by accident of birth, and also for Stan somewhat by accident of birth, but also accident of the way the economy was going in that time when he got started, you know, they ended up at these little redheaded stepchildren industries. You know, these were not, I say that as a redheaded stepchild, I'm allowed to say that. But it's not like Stan Lee grew up longing to write comic books. And Vince McMahon, as best as I can tell, up until he was 12 and met his father, who was a wrestling promoter, he didn't really watch wrestling or aspire to be involved in wrestling. In both Stan's case and Vince's case, it was kind of the arbitrary nature of nepotism and who your family is that worked out into putting them into these media, whether it's comics or wrestling. And then both of them really proceeded to, in different ways and to different degrees and with different collaborators, revolutionize those industries and turn them into something, I wish I had a better word than cool, but that was the idea. You know, Marvel in the 60s was not even the, you know, most successful pop culture property of the 60s, but it was really cool. It was very hip. And wrestling has gone through two peaks under Vince McMahon, where bizarrely, we sort of take it for granted now, but bizarrely, wrestling became cool under Vince. You know, you had in the mid-80s, the Hulk Hogan phenomenon and all the wrestlers that surrounded Hogan. We sort of make fun of it now, but at the time, people accepted it for what it was, which was sort of kitsch and camp. I mean, now we look at it and we're like, oh, that's so silly. They knew it was silly at the time, but that campy, slightly winking approach was really appealing to the MTV viewers of the day. I mean, wrestling really blew up in many ways in the mid-80s because Vince was able to partner with MTV when it was at the peak of its influence. And then the late 90s, when I was watching wrestling, again, Vince with Stone Cold Steve Austin and Dwayne The Rock Johnson and others really rose to the top of cultural prominence. And according to a Gallup poll of 1999, as of then, some, you know, 50 million people in America were watching wrestling. So they both changed their industries, made them cool, and then watched them change even further than they had anticipated and maybe had to play catch up.
It's the treatment. My guest who calls Stan Lee a writer is Abraham Josephine Reisman. Books, terrific books on empire builders and pop culture, are a true believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, and her most recent book is Ringmaster, Vince McMahon and the Unmaking of America. And it's something I want to ask you about, and I think it really appends to both of them. And I actually got to ask Stan about this, and he kind of went, huh, which is that both of these creators took the fulcrum of soap opera and applied them to these two media.
That is very accurate. The serialized melodrama, which soap operas really pioneered, was enormously influential on both Marvel and WWF, WWE, Vince's wrestling company. In both cases, I'm not sure that either Vince or Stan were avid soap viewers, or in Stan's case, when he was growing up, listeners, but you can't help but notice that that kind of storytelling, which was first present in soap operas, really did come to comics, certainly, in that comics, like soap operas, are an endless narrative. You know, superhero comics, I should say. The big two companies, Marvel and DC, those mythologies are constantly continuing and evolving and referencing themselves and all of that. And always the soap opera element is, oh, what am I going to do about my problems? You know, that's the thing that keeps people coming back, is you have characters they like, and you put the characters in situations where they have horrible personal problems, and then you can relate to them. You know, it's a brilliant idea. And in wrestling, similarly, Vince started having it be a much more serialized story, although continuity is not really that important in wrestling, whereas it is in comics. But he had all of this drama. I mean, when I was watching wrestling addictively as a teenager, for me, the most important thing was the words. The actual matches, I kind of could take or leave, except for the commentary that was being done by the play-by-play and color commentators. That language was so enticing to me. And you're right, a lot of that is owed to the sort of over-the-top soliloquies of the soap.
You think about the big matches in the Marvel comics of Stan Lee's quote-unquote writing days, the Thing or the Hulk fighting each other, or Thor or Hercules or whomever, there was never really a clear winner in any of those battles. It was all about the sort of the psychological Sturm und Drang going on within the characters and how they took measure of themselves.
You're right. You're right. I mean, the fact is there's only so much, at least in modern storytelling, that you can do with just a fight. Like, here's a big fight. Here's a good guy. Here's a bad guy. They're having a fight. There was a time when you could get away with that pretty well in pop culture. Wrestling, for example, used to be just, for the most part, unathletic gentlemen holding each other in ostensibly, you know, submission holds that either hurt or didn't, but certainly didn't hurt as much as they were telegraphing them to look like. And then pinning each other. You know, there wasn't a whole lot in the way of acrobatics or athletics, but that fight, just the fact that there was a good guy and a bad guy fighting, was what brought you there. And in comics, similarly, you had like all of these superhero comics in the early days of superhero comics that really were just along those lines, like superhero meets supervillain, they fight, that's it. What both Vince and Stan and Jack Kirby and collaborators of Vince, I don't want to write out everybody who's not part of the auteur theory here, what they figured out was you can really get far if you take a fight and add angst. You know, if you add, oh, well, this fight is a metaphor for this person's internal struggle, or this is a fight that this person is having with, you know, their ex-wife who happens to be a supervillain, you know, that kind of thing makes it a lot more interesting. Or the classic Spider-Man dilemma, which is, I'm fighting this guy, but I also have to pick up Aunt May's heart medicine by 5 p.m. or else she's going to die, you know, that sort of thing. You need to have that extra element of psychological anxiety to make the fight interesting for modern readers or viewers.
Just reading the books, I just find myself really sort of falling into this sort of continuum of the connection. And if I can mix a bunch of metaphors here, but what I found myself thinking is you know, Spider-Man is not only fighting and hoping he can like get home to his aunt in time so she doesn't worry about him being out after dark, but also the fact that he's fighting a villain and he's perceived as a villain. And, you know, so that the apotheosis of that is Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who plays a villain like a hero and a hero like a villain.
That is exactly right. I mean, that gets into the complication that I tried to give a name in the Ringmaster book, in the Vince McMahon book, which is neo-kayfabe. You know, kayfabe used to be the old sort of term for the fakeness of professional wrestling. It was used within the industry. You know, you'd say like, oh, kayfabe, you'd like use it as an imperative to say like, hey, an outsider's coming by. We got to hold up our illusion of being enemies right now or being friends or whatever. But neo-kayfabe, the status quo that we have now, is much more complicated because it used to be that wrestling was presenting you with this equation of what you are seeing in the ring tonight is real. You can believe it. Even if it is ridiculous, believe in it. Now, wrestling does not claim that what happens in the ring is real. In fact, it starts with the assumption that what you're seeing is fake. But here's where it gets interesting, and there's a parallel to this in comics. You start muddying the waters by messing with our sense of morality and our sense of reality. Well, reality insofar as you have the wrestlers like say things that are unspeakably true, you know, say things that are like references to wrestlers, you know, the other wrestlers' personal problems outside the ring that have been reported on in blogs or whatever. You toss in some reality within the fakeness and viewers all of a sudden are really intrigued. And then to make it even more spicy, you can mess with the moral valences and you can end up with a situation, like you said, where The Rock is the most popular protagonist wrestler, but he's not a good guy per se. You know, the same was true with Stone Cold Steve Austin. These were people who were sort of the protagonists, the heroes, but they didn't act like heroes. They acted like jerks all the time, and that was something that really appealed to people. Now in superhero comics, it tends to work in slightly the opposite way, where it's you want people to read the superheroes and think of them as relatably sort of adorable or warm. Even if they have a hard exterior, you want to believe they have a heart of gold. Keep coming back to that. But either way, you're doing that neo kayfabe two-step of messing with people's expectations and messing with people's senses of what up and down are and what, you know, what everything is.
We'll take a break. My guest is Abraham Josephine Reisman, whose books are True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, and her new book is Ringmaster, Vince McMahon and the Unmaking of America. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is Abraham Josephine Reisman, whose new book is Ringmaster, The Vince McMahon and the Unmaking of America. But more importantly, we're here to talk about the book, True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee. In so many ways, I find myself thinking about, I mean, how Stan, who connecting with these artist writers such as Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and Wally Wood, these are all people, getting back to the thesis we started this with, who had a better understanding of themselves as creators than Stan did. That intersection of the persona coming in really with both Thor and the Asgard world for Jack Kirby and Fantastic Four, and these characters wrestling with self-hatred, and Steve Ditko's literal determinism in Spider-Man, but all, many of these guys, but Kirby and Ditko in particular, as you point out in the book, are people who start off as doing sort of horror comics that weren't very scary, but once they turned into superhero fiction, they actually were able to create works that were sort of profoundly disturbing in psychological terms.
You know, the hot thing in comics prior to the Marvel Revolution was horror and then sci-fi. And you often blended the sci-fi with horror, you know, Monsters from Outer Space and such. And that training was really crucial for two creative pairings, Jack Kirby and Stan Lee and Steve Ditko and Stan Lee, as you identified. Both Ditko and Kirby did a tremendous amount of work with Stan as editor and possibly to some extent as a co-writer in the late 50s into the very early 60s. The thing that always strikes me about that is Jack in his sci-fi and monster stories was really good at coming up with unbelievably striking creatures and visuals. You look at what he was doing in the mid-50s, and then what he's doing by Fantastic Four, and it looks radically different. And the link between those two is this, the horror and sci-fi comics. But Ditko is what is especially interesting to me, because Ditko and Stan, their stories in the comic Amazing Fantasy or Amazing Adult Fantasy, it had a bunch of different names, but that's the one where Spider-Man was introduced in its final issue. Everything up until that issue had been eerily similar to Spider-Man, except not about superheroes. The thing that was in eerie similarity was they were all basically O. Henry stories. They all had these little ironic moral twists at the end. And what you always have to remember is no one thought these superhero comics that were coming out from the company that became Marvel were going to be hits. It was not like, okay, we're going to roll out our next big sensation. They were just throwing stuff at the wall. So they stuck with a lot of the formulas that they had come up with in the previous genres that they've been working with. And Spider-Man is just an O. Henry story. The essence of the Spider-Man story, the first one, the most important thing about that story is the moral twist at the end, right?
Because that's the manufactured moral twist at the end of the book.
Manufactured, the totally ludicrous moral twist. But that moral twist is the essence of it. And all the other trappings would not have gone anywhere if not for that clever moral twist. You can see that exact kind of thing constantly happening in the comics prior to that.
What I like so much about True Believer is that you offer the history of the phrase that people so often associate with sort of the ethos of Spider-Man that has provenance that really predates 1962.
Oh, with great power, there must come great responsibility. Yes. Well, yeah, for one thing, everybody always misquotes it. It's not with great power, there comes great responsibility. It's with great power, there must also come great responsibility, which I think is actually an important distinction, because with great power comes great responsibility implies that when you have great power, you suddenly realize that you have lots of responsibility. Oh, if only that were true. You know, I don't think the Elon Musks of the world particularly see that equation. But the thing that was great about the original phrasing was there must come. It's always it's imperative. It's saying you have to do this. This is urgent. But yeah, the phrasing on it, as you say, it had antecedents. Let's say that. I can't say for sure that Stan ripped it off from somebody, but Stan gets a lot of credit for that that little moral equation of great power equals great responsibility. But yeah, as I say in the book, you know, Winston Churchill said that. FDR said that in a speech that he was going to deliver before he died, and then he died, but it got published anyway, so Stan could have seen that. The National Convention of the French Revolution in French had a phrase not unlike that. So I can't prove that Stan ganked it from anybody, but he at least was not the only one to have come up with the sentiment. Let's say that.
But that section of the book really sets into motion, and I think in a profound way, the idea of Stan sort of standing next to the person who gets shot and getting a Purple Heart anyway, so to speak. His ability to sort of be near things. And this is not to say that he wasn't in his way talented, but probably the most important Marvel comic, two most important Marvel comics that come out of that era were the Galactus story and the Spider-Man 31 through 33, both of which are about these moral and psychological conflicts, that kind of apotheosis for both teams of creators, that you can see the difference in Stan Lee's work without those two, but you can also see the difference in Kirby and Ditko. And for as much credit as these guys don't get for the incredible amount of work they did as creators, there's a felicity with dialogue about martyrdom that Stan brought to those books that without the kind of really sort of almost orotund suffering and dialogue in Fantastic Four and Spider-Man, that intersection wouldn't exist, would it?
I mean, you read the dialogue that Kirby and Ditko wrote in the comics that they unambiguously were the sole auteurs for, and it's just not as compelling, you know? It's not as memorable. It's not as snappy. I actually happen to be very fond of Kirby's writing in the Fourth World, not because it's enjoyable, but because it's interesting. You know, It's unlike dialogue in any other comic, really. But that's appropriate because he's trying to write a new Bible, you know? So it sounds
it's so declamatory and without nuance that it's kind of, it's like, it really is the first kind of dialogue that doesn't demand exclamation points.
But it has a lot of them. There's a lot of exclamation points in there.
It does. But, you know, in all those books, everything, be it a description in the top of the panel or a line of dialogue, is a declamation.
Oh, yeah. It's always, you know, let's start the first sentence out and then end with an exclamation point. Then the next one will have three exclamation points to show we're really serious. And then the next sentence, when we really blow your mind, we'll have like eight exclamation points. It's crazy. It makes like people typing on Instant Messenger look positively frugal in their use of punctuation. But anyway, the point is Kirby's dialogue and narration is interesting. But it would not have gotten over in the way that Stan's did, you know? It's interesting in that Stan's dialogue doesn't really sound hip now, kind of at all. It sounds basically just as stilted as Kirby's in the Fourth World. But at the time, in the 60s, I am assured, I was not alive then, but I am assured that as of like 1963, Stan Lee's little Hepcat word jazz for all of his characters was something that really resonated for people. But you're right. Also, he was really good, or at least distinctive and memorable, in writing about martyrdom. I love that you use that word because that's exactly what it was. It was always, you know, he may have been Jewish, but he kind of ran away from the Jewish stuff and ended up with some very Christian style moments of people going through suffering and sort of being purified by that suffering, or at least the suffering being the thing that good people do.
My guest is Abraham Josephine Weissman. Her book is True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, which we're talking about because this is in the kind of sort of 60th anniversary of Spider-Man. But as a kid, my first encounter with Fellini and René were reading about them in Stan Lee's soapbox. And at one point, I did actually meet JC, his daughter, who said, well, he never knew those people. I told him those guys were. He didn't know who they were. So then you get into that relationship too.
A little bit. Yeah. Fellini, the great film directors, Fellini and René, were both allegedly fans. I mean, Alain René definitely was. You know, René worked with Stan. They tried to get a movie off the ground that didn't work. But the story is that Fellini just sort of showed up at the Marvel offices one day in the 60s, barged in and talked to Stan about how much he loved Marvel. And Stan told that story a lot, very proudly, but what I sort of uncovered, you know, I talked to the late Denny O'Neill, who was a terrific comics writer and prior to that journalist, and he told me that he was working in the office that day and Fellini walks in and all of the young creatives, because you have to remember, Stan was pretty old by this point. He was in his 40s, you know, but all the young, the kids in their 20s are like, oh my God, it's Fellini. It'd be like, you know, the Safdie brothers showing up today or something. All the hipsters knew who Fellini was. And then he has this conversation in Stan's office. Nobody knows what happens in there. He walks out. And then after Fellini's out of the building, according to Denny O'Neill, Stan just starts turning to people and going, who was that guy? You know, I have no idea who that was. He apparently likes my comics. So could be false, but I'm inclined to believe it.
I'm talking about the impact and the influence of Marvel. And certainly, in some weird way, the melodrama in those comics, I mean, and maybe it's too grandiloquent to get into other media, but, you know, the grandeur or the suffering of those characters.
They're trapped. That's what I'll say, is like the suffering of these characters is so palpable. And part of what makes it compelling is you have trapped them. Like, you are the one who keeps coming back and saying, I want to see more Captain America stories, or I want to read more Spider-Man stories, whatever. And because of that, these characters that you love so much never get to be free and have the bliss of death and oblivion. You know, they have to constantly be brought back, no matter how many times they die or retire or whatever. They have to come back and suffer more for you. You know, Grant Morrison, the comics writer, they said this a lot in their comics, that we as consumers of fiction really just torture these figures that we claim to love so much because we just want to see them suffer over and over again, even if that's not how we think about it. Maybe we just think we like to see them have the happy endings. But you can't have a happy ending if you don't have some suffering in the middle there. the thing that always blows my mind about Marvel and DC to a lesser extent, but especially Marvel, is that unified corpus of stories. The only thing that it can be compared to, other than the DC universe, which is sort of a shadow of this continuity beast, is the Bible. Like, literally, the only thing I can compare the Marvel universe to in terms of its intertextuality, its length, its depth of interpretation within its own texts, of its own text, all of that stuff, all the different authors, the contradictions that try to get resolved, it's a holy text. I mean, even if you don't like Marvel, you have to appreciate that the complexity and the size, the sheer size of that story is unlike anything created in modern times.
I was going to ask you, though, because as you were saying that, it occurred to me that the Shakespeare historical plays, to some extent, feel like that, too.
The Shakespeare historical universe. That's great. But yeah, they are all kind of in this, you know, the histories are all this tale of a really terrible country called, you know, England or Scotland or whatever. That, like, it's just this, it's similarly, like, over and over, you tune into Shakespeare to hear another story set in this universe of the kingdom you live in, where everything goes terribly all the time.
Certainly the Bible, but also because, again, that sort of Venn diagram, and I hate that turn of phrase, of heroism and melodrama is plays out in Shakespeare in that way, and low comedy.
Shakespeare totally would have written for comic books if he'd been around. Or maybe wrestling, for that matter. You know, I mean, the theater was a populist thing. It was lowbrow. And I love that. That's a very good comparison. My spouse would love that. The writer and editor, S.I. Rosenbaum, is always telling me that you have to remember Shakespeare was low culture. You know, you have to approach it as fun, as salaciousness, not as something that's inaccessible and there just to be analyzed with your brain. And that's what's great about comics. You know, Art Spiegelman, the great cartoonist, has a great line about how the great thing in comics, given their simplicity, relative simplicity to, say, portrait painting or something, they're like an ice pick that just goes through your defenses, past your defenses, and then like pierces your brain. And wrestling is the same way. Wrestling knows how to push those buttons in your brain. Even if you're going, God, this is so stupid, this is so hackneyed, you can't look away because it knows how to mess with you. And I think that's a beautiful thing. I think low culture that succeeds is often the greatest culture simply because it has the best understanding of what people are actually like, not necessarily in terms of their depictions on the page, but in terms of what makes people come back and read more stories.
I can't thank you enough, and please come back and do the show again, Josie.
I would love to. This was such a good time. Thank you so much.
Cultural Observer Abraham Josephine Reisman's 2021 book on one of the architects of the Marvel Age of Comics is True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee. Upcoming from her is the book Ringmaster, Vince McMahon and the Unmasking of America, Past, Present, and Future. Hear it all at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. So if you took a story about a marginalized community and a soldier breaking away from institutionalism and how the world is changed by the time the sun goes down and night embraces it, who would have realized that the story of Carmen would still be so adaptable to today? But my guest, director and co-writer Benjamin Mupie, has done a terrific job of turning it into a contemporary movie. Benjamin, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
And it is that. I mean, it's kind of funny to think about all those things. It's about sort of in this marginalized community and about this soldier who has to come to understand who he is by breaking away from an institution. Was it all those things that sort of like made you see how it connected to the contemporary world?
I was interested in the love story to grow out of a world in chaos. I would say a place of chaos. And certainly I explored different adaptation idea, different places, but I wanted to recreate the story in a place that I related to. And obviously, like, I lived in Los Angeles for 10 years and in the US, and I myself was born in France, grew up in Senegal, and moved to New York when I was 15, and just had this experience of having a freeing passion and following it across borders and in very different circumstances, obviously, because I was totally privileged to travel easily. And it was interesting when I, obviously, the essence of the story, the gypsy in Carmen, the Roma in Carmen, was really important. The idea of this woman who's free, who has this integrity and will and knows exactly who she is. And so to attach it to, you know, to keep the attachment, the foundation to that culture, when I looked into it, I think that's what made the decision. Is when I looked at the Roma community in Mexico, there's actually a very significant community who immigrated in the 20th century, who started to notoriously like travels and still to this day by trucks and puts on performances and movies. And I did a bit of research, and there's an anthropologist who studied that community. And in fact, when it was still a question that I would, a potential that I would shoot in Mexico at the opening of the film, I had access to that community, and it was part of the story, and the community would have been part of the story with, like, you know, with the kind of authenticity that would have been really fascinating. But, you know, COVID happened, and then Australia was, you know, where I was going. And I thought, well, you know, this is interesting, because I had done so much scouting in Mexico that I actually quickly realized, well, this is doable in Australia. And, you know, there's the surreal, the dream quality of the film, could play to the film's advantage to be in Australia and to have something that feels exactly like Mexico, but isn't quite, you know. And it's something that I don't think people realize. And I certainly early on would show the locations to friends of mine, Mexicans who were attached, you know, working on the film. And I knew that we could recreate a kind of authenticity there. You know, obviously, like, I wasn't going to try to recreate that community in Australia. So I obviously made changes to the film, but, you know, the connection to the Roma community and why it's in Mexico and why it's a story that related to me, obviously immigration and the Western landscape and all those things are things that are part of my intellectual life and emotional life living in Los Angeles.
It's so interesting too. I mean, this, all these things are plenty of notes to talk about, but I just find myself thinking about in the film and the, so many of the stage versions try to get at this, how the world becomes a different place at night. And in your Carmen, the world explodes literally and figuratively with color at night.
Yeah. Obviously, the use of color was something that was really important to me. I love color. I've always been a photographer as a hobby for all my adult life. And I've photographed all the kinds of places in America that I went to. I became enamored with William Hagelston's photography and the quality of dye transfer print. You know, if you see the vintage prints of Hagelston, they really have this incredible depth and color. And I love Technicolor, and I just love color in general in my life. And so I knew that, you know, there would be a very specific aesthetic and language in the film, because I think we needed, you know, this, we're not in the, not at all times, we're in the dream world, we're in the, so there is a sense of trying to create something that, you know, feels like big cinema and that arresting imagery and lighting.
Well, yeah, because it goes from looking very photographic at the beginning to about 20 minutes into it, it feels really painterly. And there's a sequence near the end when Carmen is in the church that almost looks like a Renaissance painting.
It's about atmosphere. You know, it's really about creating atmosphere and tension with the setting, the imagery, the staging, the light. And I think the film, I tried to fill it with thick atmosphere that, you know, you can cut with a knife. You know, with really the kind of interaction, you know, when there's little dialogue, when there's, it's really about people having to observe, you know, we're we live in a world that everything has to be explained. And, you know, I wanted the spectator to lean forward and to kind of find the story in the emotional journey of the characters. And it's not something that you necessarily have to explain all the time. I was talking about Antonioni yesterday and how, you know, for some people, the movies feel slow. And he always said, you know, well, that's, you know, life is slow. Like, things happen in a certain time. And I find it's just sort of going against a sort of everything that we're living through right now in a world where there's kind of this rat race, this endless consumption, people living their life through like caressing a glass, you know, on their telephone, and just the kind of lack of attention, and it's really, that's why it's important. It was important for me to create exactly what I wanted to create in terms of having long moments of with no dialogue and where stories told in movement, and how the spectator has for 2 hours has to kind of have an experience and try to look beyond just what he's used to.
It's the treatment. My guest who's bringing the sensory back to movies is Benjamin Millepied. His directorial debut, we know, of course, as dancer and choreographer, is the new adaptation of the film Carmen. It's the treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. And I just found myself thinking, as you're talking about Antonioni, certainly he uses color to express mood, but I also thought about, you know, the Catholicism and the sort of the Catholic horror that goes back to Mérimée, and not only his original Carmen, but his short stories like La Venue d'Ile or Locus, about the idea of somebody coming to understand who they are too late.
Obviously, I've had a lot of the questions, like, why did you reinvent like this story that everybody loves? And as if really everybody has actually taken the time to really look at Carmen just because it's a beloved opera and think about what that story tells about this woman, you know, because really, if you look at the opera, it's very much, it's funny because I think Bizet had a kind of disgruntled marriage. I mean, that's one of the things that I've read. Carmen in the opera is a fantasy of what men think of women. And she has this sexuality and this beauty that men want to possess. And she's not a woman who can love or be loved. And essentially, she's feared. She's feared for her freedom. And she gets murdered at the end. So she gets punished for her freedom. It was really important to reinvent it because, of course, why wouldn't we want to see a strong female protagonist that is free, that is defying, that has integrity, but also she's a human. She can love. And I think really how she comes from this place where the man at the beginning of the movie want to abduct her. The child in her dream points a gun to her because that's what young boys know there. That's the example they have of how men treat women, obviously not in every case, but certainly in certain parts of that country. And we know all the horror stories. And so the idea that in this journey, she meets someone who also has gone through hell in his life. He's like so many of the men who come back from war, who are walking through life like ghosts or abandoned by the government after serving their country at war, and he's a deeply good human being, has also an opportunity to know what love is. The love scene that they have is a really, you know, it was also a point for me to make that love scene a very tender moment. You know, we're surrounded with the most extreme representation of sex and love in media culture today, and like how, you know, and obviously like pornography being such, I mean, the most watched thing on the internet. Like, I really was important for me to say, well, a love story is also like, you know, I want to see just how they undress each other, you know, and like that there's tenderness in that, there's a love in that, and that's what love is. Because we're living in a world where young people have this representation of love that is not love, you know, that is not love, and that I think it was something also for me to say, well, this woman can love and can have something beautiful where she's just recognized by this man, and she sees him and he sees her, and it's something that she carries in the journey that beyond the film, and it's something that also changes him, even though there's a different outcome to their lives in the movie.
What you're talking about, this idea of strong women and this thing that clearly terrified Mérimée, because he wrote about it so often, about strong women terrifying men. And your first scene is really kind of this condensation of everything you're talking about, with Carmen's mother being this force of nature pounding with her feet, dancing, and this car, this Mercury pulling in the distance with this rumble, and she's answering that. And there's this incredible sort of battle of wills, and this woman who refuses to step down from what she is. That's all in the first scene of your movie.
No, it's true. And I still will say that in the Marimba, it's this archetype women, but in what they're allowed to express in the stories, they're not, to me, deeply human, you know? And so I think yeah, in the opening sequence, what I set up is that there's something magical about this woman and the force of dance and the force of expression and how she's standing in front of him. He's putting a gun in her direction, and the way she performs has this sort of like hypnotic quality on him. I mean, you see sort of what happens as it builds. It just shows you who Carmen's mother is, and how even in death she accompanies her daughter throughout the journey. And I think, I just believe that too many coincidences in my life never felt quite like, were too insane to be coincidences. And I just love this idea that the fire from Carmen's mother, you know, when the house is on fire, Carmen sets her mother's house on fire, like the fire lands in Aiden's garden. And there's this idea of him kind of being chosen, you know, which is, I think, poetic.
No, I mean, there's this poetic, explosive quality that these women have. And it's fascinating to see, too, how much they understand themselves in the way that the men in the movie do not.
Yeah, they're connected through life and death and love, that you see, because the mother appears, right, later on in scenes, almost like a ghost in the film. And that's not something that I had in mind when I wrote the screenplay. The first time that I did it was because I set up the scene between Carmen and Rossi the next day after she arrives in Los Angeles. And so they have this scene, and the first time she breaks down after the death of her mother. And I knew it was going to be a very difficult and emotional scene. And so I didn't tell him I was going to shoot it in one take. I pushed everyone out. I cleared the space. I gave the Steadicam instructions. And I had called the actress who played Carmen's mother and said to her, come, hide. I'm going to put you in the seat in the club. So when Melissa turns around and sees Rossi, she'll see you there too. And it was a surprise. I thought this would be really powerful if Melissa turns around and is about to have this scene, and she sees Rossi, and in the darkness, in the shadow, she can see her mother there. And it worked. It really worked. It took her breath away when she turned, and she gave this really amazing 7-minute. They gave this amazing 7-minute. Performance in one take, which is the take that ended up in the film. And it was still funny. I did the edit, and I thought, it's just so strange when the camera turns and she's there. I kept her. I mean, I had takes where I could have at least removed her, but no one has asked about that. No one has asked about that, that it's so strange that suddenly she's there. It just works.
At what point did you realize that the movie would take on a life of its own? Because, you know, you want to sort of try to dictate where it's going to go. But obviously, this story was telling you where it was going to go, wasn't it?
You discover it in the editing room. You discover it once it's finished. You continue to learn what it is exactly you wanted to, the story you wanted to tell. And I never, because I'm so used to have this kind of freedom in my own work as a choreographer, that's the only way I can express myself. It just has to be a deep connection to who I am. And it was very much, you know, why was I interested in this protagonist? I mean, I think it was also very much witnessing the way, you know, my mother's relationship to men that were all kind of, you know, abusive in some way. And as a child, like, to have that experience and to then go into the world, you either become abusive or you learn from it. And I think I was lucky enough to have dance as my outlet to really kind of express the deep emotions that I was feeling at the time, and to kind of try and take the second position. And so I realized very much that the reason I was attracted to that story was, you know, very, very personal one.
Well, there's so much of the sort of the feminine aspect that's discussed. There's almost this sort of undercurrent of talk about mother's milk. and milk and blood, and this idea of nourishing spiritually, women nourishing each other spiritually, generation through generation. That's a big part of the story that you build out in this, Carmen.
I try to really avoid the cliches of how, like, really also let these women in my film be free to be fully expressive and to respect them and sublime them in how I film them, but without the kind of conventional, like, male gaze, just to create the environment for them to be who they are and then just capture it in the most beautiful way that I could. There was that point, there was during the script, I was writing the script, and one producer said to me, read it, and he said, why would you start the movie on an old woman? And it was a woman who said this to me. And it kind of was striking. It was like, wow, like, I that never would occur to me that anyone would ever say that, because of course this woman is gorgeous to watch. I didn't care. I didn't even think of me that she was an older woman or a younger woman, or, you know, I'm just thinking of beauty and seeing the maturity and seeing, like, everything about her is something that is engrossing and gorgeous.
I guess the thing that's just so incredible about this movie to me, Benjamin, is that it feels like something that's fully formed, that's been in your head in one way or another for a long time. A lot of the scenes, a lot of the images, the way you treat cars, like I was saying, that almost duel between Carmen's mother and that car in the distance. I mean, that's an incredible scene that tells us so much, but also the way cars inhabit the film. And it's almost back and forth between that sound of that engine sort of grunting in the distance and the music of Carmen's mother's feet, or that music in that right. nighttime sequence when Aiden is hanging on to the outside of the car and we hear those chorales. I mean, talk about the way you were using sort of like music to respond to machines.
I really wanted to walk on set and follow my instinct and make very specific decisions to how every single thing needed to be done. And you can do that with, you know, your taste and maybe your experience as an artist. But I also spent quite a bit of time alone, like, analyzing films before I shot, you know, I shot Carmen, because I was making dance films, but it was very instinctive. And I certainly wanted to kind of have a sense of craft and kind of all the possibilities. And that was one of the best things about making the movie, was watching movies and finding so many directors, particularly older directors, who have a sense of choreography that's exquisite, you know, and how they move people in space and how they move camera. And I know Elia Kazan and Kurosawa and Robert Bresson, or then someone who doesn't move the camera like Fosse, but creates movement in the editing. You know, it's just, it was so many inspiring figures, people who choose to move the camera or not move it, but, you know, most important, always feel like you forget what the camera is doing. It's moving, but it's really about the emotion. It's not about showing everybody you can be a virtuoso, you know, which we see a lot now too. So I think these decisions were, by the time I got on set, they were very specific. I knew how I wanted the car to be filmed. I knew how the sound should be. I knew that the feet could become really overwhelming. I also surrounded by a very talented team, you know, very talented group of people working on the movie. And they brought, I mean, the sound designer is Neva Deary is remarkable. It's the dream. Like, and I learned that as a choreographer, you want to surround yourself with people who are going to have ideas you're not going to have yourself, you know, and kind of really enrich the vision beyond your own potential. And that was very much the case on this film. I think I've worked enough with collaborators that I know that you have to inspire them, but you also have to let them be free to be as creative as possible. And when that happens, it's a match made in heaven. You get more ideas and more potential to what you had in mind. And I remember getting the first mix from Neve of that first scene, and it was more than I would have expected. It's more than I would have done. And it was fabulous, because he really kind of was like, this is how I think it should be. This is my experience of the film. This is how I think it should be. And I was very lucky, you know, I was very lucky to have his talent on the film.
Because you were talking about Bresson and Antonioni, and the way they deal with the natural world with exterior is present here, but also that idea of sound as kind of music concrete and working in concert with the music, but also in a contrapuntal way. I mean, it's a really, I said in the first half, it's really a sensory experience, this movie.
Yeah, I mean, naturally being, you know, first and foremost, I'm a dancer because of music. Music is everything. It's just, you know, I find pieces of music that mean something to me in a moment in my life, and I choreograph them. So I love music. I have very eclectic taste in music and sound. And so the sound obviously was going to be an important component, because it can really impact in interesting ways your experience. So yeah, so it was pretty exhilarating to create, I have to say.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your time, Benjamin. My guest is Benjamin Millepied, his first film as director, and I can't wait to see what he's going to do next. It's his adaptation of Prosper Mérimée's Carmen. Benjamin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Don't slip away. Stray
with me. The newest feature film version of Carmen comes to us from the mind of first-time film director Benjamin Millepied. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Lonely wild open plains, barren skies, circling birds of prey. The wind groans, whistling his shame. Don't slip away. Stray with me forever, like sand on the ocean. Don't slip away. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat. Saying they come from the worlds of stage, screen, and television is not a cliche for Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez. It's a hard fact. Their newest project is for the small screen, the musical romantic comedy drama series Up Here, which they did for Hulu. And right here, The Treats, a book and a song that both bloomed into something epic.
I'm Kristen Anderson Lopez, and this is The Treat. The thing that came to mind was L.M. Montgomery's book, Anne of Green Gables. I'm just wanting to riff on Anne of Green Gables because it's one of the first books that I ever read where I saw a female protagonist with feelings as big as mine, and feelings that made her make terrible decisions and made her be incredibly emotional, and also strong feelings that helped her live a life that felt magical and meaningful, and the kind of life that I wanted to have when I read it as a girl.
You're a rude, impolite, unfeeling woman, and I hate you!
Anne Shirley!
How would you like to have nasty things said about you? How would you like to be told that you're fat and ugly and a sour old gossip?
And I bring that up because our protagonist in Up Here, played by Mae Whitman, our protagonist Lindsay, wants to have a big life with big feelings and big risks and big romances, because I think that she's getting in touch with all of the big yearning inside of her. And so I don't think Lindsay would exist. I don't think Anna would exist. I don't think any of my female characters, I don't think Nana Imelda would exist from Coco without Anne of Green Gables and this wonderful protagonist who's messy and big and bright.
I'm Bobby Lopez, and this is The Treat. I thought I would talk a little bit about one of my favorite classic rock influences, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. He was the musical genius behind a lot of their music, and then really flowered into this incredible artist in his own right, who not only played with harmony, but also the different sounds that you could make in the studio and the recording techniques. Maybe my very favorite song of all songs is God Only Knows from Pet Sounds. It's one of those songs that is a critical hit and an audience favorite.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it.
It's got so much love in it, but it's like a Fabergé egg, the way it's constructed. Not only just the vocal counterpoint, but the basic relationship between the melody and the bass is one of the most complicated bits of harmonic and counterpoint work that you will see in a work of pop music. It's the kind of song that you can play over and over again, forgetting each little detail and remembering it again, and realizing that the forces that chose these notes were truly, truly inspired. It's really a musician's song because it's the details that create the divine lift that the song gives you. And it would have been our wedding song, except for the very first lyric, which is, I may not always love you, which is probably a very true statement in every marriage, but just not good for the first dance of a wedding.
God only knows what I'd be without you.
Composers who bring something personal to their work and the treat. Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez. Their new project is a Hulu series, Up Here. Past treats, including married creators Michelle and Robert King, are at kcrw.com/thetreat. Whether married or working solo, the minds that bring us the treat are something singular, and their take on the moment of revelation that laid the ground for their careers and their lives is something that brings inspiration to all who listen. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. We got help from Anna Buss and Laura Kondarajan. And to better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.